This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. Today, a look inside the brain with neuroscientists who are researching what happens when we experience anger or compassion.
I mean, it's amazing what you can do with MRI. We can vary the magnetic fields a bit to make these incredible pictures.
Can our brains be trained to help us respond more compassionately and peacefully to the world?
We have some evidence to indicate that these are indeed characteristics that can be enhanced. And I think through their enhancement, we can improve peacemaking both within ourselves as well as with others.
If you will, we have a reflective science, a form of reflective skills we can teach based on science that actually widen our circles of compassion and dissolve what Albert Einstein called the optical delusion of our separateness.
The neuroscience of compassion. That's ahead on Peace Talks Radio. This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. On our program, we spotlight the art and science of peacemaking throughout history and in our lives today. Whether it's the search for inner peace or learning how to resolve conflicts we have with others in our families, workplaces, communities, or between nations, we consider it here on Peace Talks Radio. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls. And today we consider inner peace in a very literal way as we look inside the brain with neuroscientists who are researching what happens when we experience anger or compassion. Having learned what certain emotions look like in the brain, the researchers are seeing if an infusion of compassion and empathy through practices similar to ancient mindfulness meditation can quell the stress. And can the brain be trained, in effect, to not only experience less stress, but to help that person respond more compassionately and peacefully to the world? Studies are suggesting that might be possible, and we'll talk with some of the leading researchers in the field shortly. But first, we get a look at one of the facilities where brain research is going on, the Mind Research Network in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Hi, should we start here? Can I walk in, Kathy?
Absolutely. I have no patient. I'm just trying to get you some information out.
Dr. Okay. John Phillips, a medical doctor who oversees experiments here, and Dr. Pilar San Juan, a brain scientist, lead a tour for our host, Suzanne Kreider. We see lots of dark, cool rooms where the brain imaging machines await to peek into the gray matter of experimental subjects. In one room, a research assistant named Kathy calls up a four-square brain scan on a high-def computer monitor. It's a picture of a subject's brain, whose head had recently been scanned by the fairly enormous magnetic resonance image, or MRI, machine that we see through the glass.
Dr. Phillips, describe what it looks like.
Well, it's like a large, big donut, I guess, and you're going into the middle of it. When we do our kid studies, we tell them it's like you're going into a submarine bore. So you're laying down on this gurney or this table. It brings you up, and then you slide partway into that. Now, the big donut is really a magnet that's super cooled by helium around there, so that's a very powerful magnet and allows us to do different things to some of the protons in the brain to give us the pictures that we're seeing. I mean, it's amazing what you can do with MRI, but with this, we can vary the magnetic fields a bit to make these incredible pictures. So we get detailed structure. As you can see, we can look at various views of the brain. We can actually put it together three-dimensionally as we scroll through it. I mean, it's amazing. It's like a fantastic voyage as you're skating through your own brain. It's just amazing.
Now, the technician here who has a computer screen can look at different views of a person's brain, and it looks like you can actually see some of the different aspects of the brain. Like, that's the brain stem.
That's right. We have a very good picture of the brain stem, the back part of the brain called the cerebellum, the connection from one side of the brain to the other, which is called the corpus callosum, and the huge hemispheres of the brain. And we can go into that other picture. We can get down real small, too, the spectroscopy picture, Kathy, so that we can look not only at what the brain looks like, but some of the brain chemistry inside the brain. You know, from a distance, the brain to me is like the size of Canada. There's so much going on in there. So if we can get a little smaller and say, well, what's the concentration of some very important chemicals in some very specific areas? We can look at that just using this magnetic imaging technology. No harmful side effects at all.
How can you all figure out when the brain is emitting neural firings that we call emotions or feelings?
Well, I'm not sure I can tell you when that's happening, but I can tell you where things are happening. And one way I can tell you where they're happening is something called functional MRI. I'm not sure if we can bring that up, Kathy, or not. Now, functional MRI takes advantage of the fact that we know that as your brain, which is composed of many, many neurons, if a specific part of that brain, if some neurons are being more active because maybe that's the emotional part of your brain that's working a little overtime, the blood to that area increases a little bit because active neurons need a little more blood supply so they can work more efficiently. That means that with a little more blood going in there, there's a little more oxygen going in that area, and we can pick up the difference in the magnetic field that the oxygen gives us. So by using functional MRI scan, we can tell exactly where in the brain some activity is happening.
Can you tell different kinds of activity, like kindness versus anger, or can you just tell where it's happening?
Those are good questions, and I certainly don't know the answer, but I can tell you where it's happening, and maybe we can design some experiments so that we show pictures of different faces, or we have people think different things that might make them, we would summarize, feeling kindness or anger, and then we can see what the response on the functional MRI is in response to that subject looking at those pictures.
And we have some idea that some different emotions tend to occur more in some places than others.
Dr. Pilar San Juan is studying the brains of people suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder.
So in the pilot study that I'm doing right now, I'm going to be looking at fear, actually. So we'll be showing them pictures of fearful faces, which elicits fear in people. And so I expect to see certain parts light up. I expect a part called the amygdala to light up. And I expect a part called the ventromedial prefrontal cortex to light up, which kind of controls the amygdala. And I expect it to light up differently in people who have PTSD and people who don't have PTSD, because people with PTSD should be feeling more fear and have less control of it.
We'll hear more from Dr. San Juan later, but first, a conversation with Dr. Richard Davidson, a research professor of psychology and psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. In 2006, Time magazine named him one of the world's most 100 influential people. His labs use a variety of technologies, including the same functional MRI Dr. Phillips was demonstrating, to study patterns in brain function. One focus of Dr. Davidson's work is on the regulation of emotion, looking at the interactions between the different parts of the brain Dr. San Juan referenced, specifically the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala. Davidson studied normal patients, patients with anxiety disorders, and highly trained Buddhist monks. Here's Suzanne Kreider.
Our program is about making peace. And based on your research, can people really regulate their brains in some way so that we can make peace with ourselves and other people more effectively?
Well, I think that the research is certainly pointing in that direction. Our research indicates that characteristics like compassion and kindness and cooperation are all best regarded as the product of skills that can be trained. And they can be enhanced because of our brains. Our brains are what neuroscientists call plastic, which means that they can be changed in response to experience and to training. And so we have some evidence to indicate that these are indeed characteristics that can be enhanced. And I think through their enhancement, we can improve peacemaking both within ourselves as well as with others.
Why is it that some people are more sensitive to threats than others?
Well, like other complicated behavioral characteristics, it's probably an interaction of both genetic contributions as well as learned past history and current context.
Let's imagine that I'm perceiving something that's threatening. Actually, I saw some cockroaches in my kitchen the other night, and it was amazing how quickly I responded to that visual cue, and then I screamed. Now, what does your research say about how I could regulate that response or more quickly recover from that response?
Well, there are parts of the brain that are very important for emotion regulation. And the amygdala, for example, is modulated, we know, by parts of the prefrontal cortex. And individuals who are skilled in emotion regulation are capable of both more automatically recovering quickly from a negative event like seeing a cockroach. And they can also deploy more intentional and voluntary strategies to activate these regions of prefrontal cortex, which then in turn will regulate activity in an area like the amygdala. So these areas of the brain are highly interconnected and they work in balance. And our regulation of emotion very much depends upon that kind of circuitry.
Tell us about some of the intentional voluntary strategies that are helpful in regulating the brain.
We have investigated strategies that are derived from a number of different kinds of traditions. One is cognitive therapy, where there is a body of evidence to suggest that cognitive therapy can help reduce the symptoms of depression and anxiety. This is one of the most well-validated, empirically well-validated psychological treatment strategies for depression and anxiety. And using those kinds of methods, which involve reappraising a stimulus, so for example, in the case of the cockroach, it would be saying, well, you know, most cockroaches really are not very dangerous. There's probably not very many of them. Many other people have cockroaches. It's not a big deal. That would be an example of cognitive reframing and reappraisal to minimize the impact of that stimulus. There are other kinds of emotion regulation strategies that we've worked with that are derived from contemplative traditions. And one of the most effective is the active, intentional, voluntary cultivation of positive emotional states to counteract negative emotional states. And the two most common positive emotional states that are cultivated through these kinds of contemplative trainings are compassion and loving kindness. There is a beginning of a research literature on these kinds of practices, and they show that they dramatically alter certain parts of the brain and may help with the kind of example that you gave of a cockroach, because one of the things that you do in loving kindness and compassion meditation is you actually extend the feelings of positive affect to all living beings, which would include a cockroach. And so it would be reflecting on the view that cockroaches also have a right to live. It kind of changes your attitudinal stance, if you will, toward the cockroach.
Give our listeners some instructions, simple instructions on how to do this compassion training.
First of all, there's a lot of resources available on the web and elsewhere for guided instruction on these practices, but they involve typically the silent repetition of a phrase like, may you be free from suffering, may you live a life of ease. A person would silently repeat phrases of that sort about and direct them to themselves. So may I be free from suffering, may I live a life with ease. It may be directed toward a loved one. It may be directed toward a person with whom one has difficulty, who kind of pushes your buttons. And it could also be directed to all living beings, including cockroaches. The individual is asked to practice repeating this phrase over and over again, but not just cognitively, experiencing the phrase more emotionally, paying particular attention to bodily sensations that may be associated with its repetition, particularly around the area of the heart. That's really the essence of the practice. And a person typically does this for 20 or 30 minutes at a time or even longer. We've done research on these kinds of practices and find that the brain is certainly changed by these practices after just 2 weeks of training.
You're able to measure brain changes while people are doing the practices, but let's say I'm calling the phone company for the third time and I'm not meditating while I'm calling. If I meditated that morning, am I retaining some kind of effect?
Yeah, our research indicates the answer to that question is yes. Some of our studies are during the meditation state, but other studies that we do are not during the meditation state. That is, we test people who have learned to practice these kinds of meditation procedures, but who are not currently meditating, looking at how they respond differently to, for example, images like a cockroach, compared to other people who've not gone through that kind of training, who've gone through another kind of training that is really quite different in its orientation. These kinds of practices wouldn't be very interesting if all they did is change how you feel while you're practicing, but had no effect on everyday life after you finish formal practice. And in fact, one can say that the goal of these practices is to completely obliterate the distinction between periods of formal practice and everyday life.
Dr. Richard Davidson, research professor at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. We'll talk more with him later in our program, and in a moment, we'll hear from another top brain researcher about how what's called mindfulness practice could help us train our brains to be more compassionate to ourselves and others. We'll also hear what's being learned to help our children become more compassionate. And we'll hear from His Holiness the Dalai Lama, the Tibetan leader who's been keenly interested in and involved with the science of compassion. That's all ahead on Peace Talks Radio after this break. You're listening to Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. All the programs in our series, including more information about this episode, can be found on our website, peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, and today we're exploring whether we can train our brains so that we can be more peaceful with ourselves and with other people. And we're talking with brain researchers who've been conducting experiments with subjects, some who practice various types of silent meditation, and then others who don't. Then, using high-tech imaging equipment, the researchers look for changes in brain activity and subject-reported attitudes. Dr. Dan Siegel is another leading researcher in this field. He's currently an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine and the executive director of the MindSight Institute. That's an educational organization that focuses on how the development of insight, compassion, and empathy in individuals, families, and communities can be enhanced by examining the interface of human relations and basic biological processes. Dr. Siegel's latest book is The Mindful Brain, Reflection and Attunement in the Cultivation of Well-Being. Here's our host, Suzanne Kreider.
Explain a little bit about how mindfulness has that regulating effect on the brain.
Well, what we're beginning to understand is this, this ancient and universal practice of attuning to yourself actually harnesses the social circuits of the brain that allows you in many ways to become your own best friend. As you do that, the kindness and acceptance of yourself also support the same circuits of compassion that allow you to be understanding and kind to other people.
Without getting too complex, what are the social circuits in the brain?
Well, you know, the brain is a social organ of the body. And what this means is that from the day we're born, we need connections with other people to allow ourselves to become in balance. And when we're balanced, we literally have these areas of the brain that allow our body to function properly, our emotions to be in an even keel kind of way, and then even our thinking to be clear and tranquil. And so these circuits that allow ourselves to be balanced and regulated are the same circuits that depend on relationships with others. They're the social circuits of the brain. So in many ways, when we focus our attention inward, when we attune to ourselves, we're actually giving ourselves the same experience we would get by being loved by a caregiver, by a parent. And as an infant needs a parent, so we need ourselves to become attuned to ourselves. And when that happens, all these circuits work together to create balance and clarity.
Give us an overview about how a parent's relationship with their child can have a positive effect on their child's brain development and well-being.
You know, whatever area of the world you study, whatever culture you're looking at, there's a common way in which parents promote the healthy development of children. And that way is called attunement. It's the way a caregiver tunes in to the internal feelings of the child. And when that attunement occurs, what we think happens is that the brain of the child, which of course is immature, is allowed to attain a kind of balance. It's sometimes called equilibrium. And as the child is using this connection with the attuned parent, over time, the circuits in the child's brain that are being tuned into and allowed to be working well actually grow and develop a more independent way of being. So as that child then enters elementary school and middle school and high school, he or she has really developed the circuits of the brain from that attuned relationship that's happened over the years so that they themselves can be more independent in their capacity for balancing their emotions, for connecting to other people, and even for understanding themselves.
What does attunement look like if a child comes home from school and says something about their day? What does the parent do?
Well, the overall idea of parenting is that if the parent, the caregiver, is interested in the inner world of the child, not just the behaviors the child is doing or the events that the parent has to schedule for the kid, but actually if the parent is really tuned in and interested in the internal feelings and thoughts, the child's hopes and dreams, that's the kind of experience where the parent is seeing the mind of the child. And when that happens, children thrive. So if a child comes home from school and talks about the day, a parent should focus on not only what happened, but what the child felt about what happened. What were they thinking when this interaction happened with that kid or a teacher responded in this way? And when a parent does that, the child actually learns to understand their own internal world, and that's an incredible source of strength. So with those kinds of interactions from a parent who's interested in the mind of the child, when that parent has what's called mindsight, then the child too develops this capacity to see their mind and then to actually have more emotional intelligence, to be able to face life with more what's called resilience, that is, they're flexible and can deal with stressors, and they actually do better overall in their lives.
Dan Siegel, you spoke at a research symposium with the Dalai Lama at the Seeds of Compassion Conference in Seattle in April of 2008. And the symposium was titled "The Scientific Basis for Compassion, What We Know Now." And when you spoke, you explained that when people feel threatened, they make a bigger distinction between who is like and unlike them. And I'm really excited because these studies have proven what I have experienced personally. So I'm out in the world, and I see women who look like me, skinny, middle-aged, white, with gray hair.
Yes.
And it's some kind of weird thing, like my brain thinks I've found my tribe.
Mm-hmm.
It's not unusual for me to just walk up to strangers and say, "I love your gray hair." But the research has also shown that when people see someone who's not like them, they turn off that compassion and empathy. And you asked the Dalai Lama about how people can stay open to others, particularly at times of threat.
Yes.
Let's listen to his response.
So usually I made the distinction, the compassion. There are two kinds. One, biased, limited. One, unbiased, unlimited. Now, biological factor, that compassion is limited, biased. That, I think, common with other animals. Now we have this special brain, this intelligence. So with help of intelligence, with help of right view. As a social animal, we here, we are not isolated from the rest of the 6 billion human being. We are part of the 6 billion human being. Now right view, right perspective, thinking, that level, I'm part of the 6 billion human being. So that intelligence now helping to further strengthening our natural quality. So that love or kindness now infinite, unbiased. The first part of the compassion cannot extend towards your enemy. The second part of infinite compassion with wisdom, that can extend towards your enemy through training now, through utilized human intelligence. So that also is not necessarily for the religious believer. I think now using common sense and using the common experience.
So the Dalai Lama said there are two kinds of compassion, biological limited compassion and an intelligent unlimited compassion. I'm wondering if the research supports the concept of unlimited compassion. Dr. Siegel, can we really overcome this primal response we have of fight or flight when we feel threatened?
You know, I think the Dalai Lama's response was a very important invitation for us to not only look at the science of what is behind this more extended, intelligent form of compassion, but also to ask the question, if there's evidence that it exists, do we know that we can promote it, and how can we help people in this world generate that broader, more extended compassion so we widen our circles of concern for people? And I think there is evidence now that loving relationships can create that first biological, limited, biased form of compassion. And that's something that every child on this planet should be given the opportunity to have, that supportive relationships generate that kind of compassion we have for those near to us. But then the Dalai Lama said, as you pointed out, with mind training, we can actually go beyond this limited form of compassion that I believe we get from loving relationships. And with mind training, for example, in mindfulness practice, you can move beyond your biological tendencies. You can actually begin to stop being imprisoned by the natural biological reflexes we have, that when we're threatened, we shut off our circuits of compassion, and that we don't see from another person's point of view at those moments of being threatened. So with mind training, with mindfulness training, is really, I think, the research is looking at that now, you can, in fact, uncouple automatic reactions. You can awaken the mind and stop being on automatic pilot. Now, what this suggests is that we have a responsibility to bring this kind of mindfulness practice, this reflective skill, into the world of education and into the world even of adults who can continue to learn across the lifespan, so that, if you will, we have a reflective science, a form of reflective skills we can teach based on science that actually widen our circles of compassion and dissolve what Albert Einstein called the optical delusion of our separateness. And we come to realize, in fact, we're all a part of one human family. And preserving that family and preserving life on this planet is really a part of what the mission is for doing this kind of reflective practice.
The practices come from the Buddhist tradition. Is there any resistance that people are afraid they're being programmed, or that researchers are proselytizing to them?
You know, it's a really important question about the origins of these practices. And in The Mindful Brain, what I tried to explore was the fact that every culture has a mindfulness practice and teaching. It's been around for literally over 2,500 years in different traditions. And now it's practiced in the East and the West. And in modern times, what's happened is that researchers have gotten interested in the claims that have been across these cultures. And when you do research, you've got to pick one particular method and study it. And so it just happens that some of the methods that have been most studied have been from the Buddhist tradition of this insight meditation, otherwise known as mindfulness meditation. And so people like Jon Kabat-Zinn and Richie Davidson have explored the non-religious application in medical settings of these ancient practices. So there's absolutely nothing religious about it, but it's a very effective form of training the mind. Now, once you do the research where you're studying the effects on the brain and the effects on the immune system, the effects on your relationships with others, and your own reporting of how your mind feels that it has more clarity and balance, you come to a scientific fact that mindfulness practice improves the health of the brain, it improves the health of our relationships with each other, and improves the health of the mind. That's just absolutely clear from science. Some people who are worried about their origins do have a response, but our response is that science has shown that this is not a religious practice, this is a form of brain hygiene. I like to say, this is like brushing your brain every day. You know, we brush our teeth every day to maintain dental hygiene. Mindfulness practices are not religious. They're actually a form of brushing your brain, of keeping your brain healthy, clearing your mind, of improving your empathy for others. And so it is a wonderful biological tool that we have that has origins from thousands of years ago. But in modern times, it's clear it's a form of brain health.
In your book, The Mindful Brain, you offer several acronyms for helping people remember how to be more mindful. Talk about YODA and how that could help people be more peaceful.
Yeah. You know, the acronyms that come up in the book, The Mindful Brain, you know, are ways of remembering ideas that have lots of aspects to them. YODA is one that stands for you observe and decouple automaticity. What that means is that in reflective practice, when we develop mindful awareness, one of the streams that we develop is the capacity to observe the self. Rather than just being in the flow of sensation, we're actually observing ourselves sensing something. That is really an opportunity to stop the mind from being on automatic, from just going in a mindless fashion in a way that's habitual and coming from our biological roots. So YODA means you observe, that's the observing part, and you decouple automaticity. You stop being on automatic and you essentially awaken the mind to new possibilities.
How do we do that?
You know, it's actually unbelievably simple, but it's just a matter of people taking the time and having the intention to create a time of the day where, even if it's just for 5 minutes, you have a practice that we call a mindful awareness practice that involves focusing, let's say, on your breathing and having an awareness of where your awareness is focused. So, for example, if you do a breathing exercise or if you choose to do centering prayer or yoga or tai chi or any of the wide array of mindfulness practices, they each share in common the fact that you are being aware of your awareness. And when your awareness wanders, when you get distracted, you lovingly and gently return your focus of attention to what you intended to be focused on. In tai chi, it's the movements that are so graceful and beautiful. In yoga, it might be your postural position. In mindfulness meditation, for example, in the beginning, it's on your breath. So this practice actually builds up the circuits of awareness, and you're also paying attention to your intention. And those are the two ways, awareness of awareness and paying attention to what you intend to be focusing on, that are in common across all mindfulness practices.
But this sounds kind of tiring. I have to be aware that I'm aware. Aren't people busy enough?
You know, it's actually the opposite of tiring. Maybe hearing the phrase aware of awareness may be tiring because it's a little complicated, but it's actually quite simple and energizing. The amazing thing is that when you bring, and here's another acronym, a COLE stance. COLE is curiosity and openness and acceptance and love, that COAL stance. When you bring that kind of curiosity, it energizes you. And when you're open, you stop being imprisoned by what is. And when you're accepting, you stop making shoulds in your life that kind of restrict you and make you feel depleted of energy. And when you bring lovingness to yourself, you actually bring this sense of hope and energy into your life. So actually, this mindful practice is a way of developing more energy in your life, not less. And instead of it taking time, it actually expands time for you, where the time you do have, not just in your practice, but during the day, is made richer and more interesting. And so it feels like you've had a fuller day that's been more rewarding rather than actually taking more time.
We'll hear more from Dr. Dan Siegel, the Dalai Lama, and our other guests in a moment as we continue to explore the neuroscience of compassion today on Peace Talks Radio. More after this break. I'm Paul Ingalls, and you're listening to Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution, online at peacetalksradio.com. Today, we're exploring what's going on in our brains when we are experiencing fear, threat, and stress. And we're talking to brain researchers who are finding that some voluntary practices, similar to ancient contemplative meditation, can help train our brains to be less vulnerable to that stress and more capable of compassion and empathy. Our host, Suzanne Kreider, continues now with UCLA researcher, Dr. Dan Siegel.
Dr. Siegel, in your book, The Mindful Brain, you describe a practice that you learned on a mindfulness retreat that wasn't really mindful awareness or compassion, but it was a forgiveness practice. And it sounds like that could be helpful for peacemaking. Could you give us some instructions on how to do the forgiveness practice?
Absolutely. You know, in the tradition of Theravadan Buddhism, there is a tradition of what's called metta, M-E-T-T-A, and it's something that's found in a lot of traditions as well. The translation of this practice, which is thousands of years old, has been articulated by a number of writers like Jack Kornfield and Sharon Salzberg, and the words I'm about to give you come from my learning from Sharon Salzberg. Basically, what it is you create a state of calm and tranquility by just focusing on the breath. And that's an important place to start. You then can offer these loving kindness wishes of happiness and health, of safety and well-being to yourself and to others. And when you come to someone with whom you may have a challenging relationship or even a big conflict, what you do is you focus on the person's identity, perhaps having an image of their face. And when you feel ready, you can offer forgiveness to this person by saying in your mind, I forgive you for anything that you have said or done that has caused me pain or harm. And then in turn, you ask forgiveness from that person in the same fashion of saying, please forgive me for anything that I have said or done that has caused you pain or harm. And then, with the sharing of forgiveness, you then offer these wishes of loving kindness to this person with whom you have a conflict. And that can be offering them the wish for happiness and a joyful heart, for health and a body that gives them energy, for safety and the protection from harm, and for the ease that comes with well-being. And when we offer these loving kindness wishes, it actually enriches our own sense of compassion for others in the forgiveness and the loving kindness wishes, but also for ourselves, that we generate what's called self-compassion. And in this way, we're really building these circuits of compassion in the brain that allow us to let go of automatic grudges and automatic ways we're imprisoned by our being angry at others, and we can move beyond these grudges into forgiveness. And actually, that's been shown to promote our physical health, our emotional well-being, as well as the clarity of our minds.
At the Seeds of Compassion conference in Seattle, the Dalai Lama said that religious people have a limited power to impact making the world more peaceful. Let's listen to his comments.
So religious people, 1,000 years, repeat these things, but effect limited. We are not much using common sense, right? But rather you say God or Buddha like that, it's okay. No harm. But effect limited, I think. Sometimes you see that. Oh. Your work, your expertise, right? Actually, making a contribution. Now I think the hopeful sign is more and more people, mainly from the scientific community, now is showing, the deeper realization of deeper reality. I think that's really a hopeful sign. So from my viewpoint, even those like Hitler, or Bin Laden, or Stalin, or Chairman Mao, when they are children, same capacity. They grown up under their mother's kindness. So even these people, later, due to certain circumstances, some cases political power, then these person become arrogant. But basic human nature level, same, isn't it?
Mm.
So education and environment really makes differences. So now their education is, I feel, very, very important. So scientists have greater responsibility than a religious person like me.
His Holiness said that scientists actually have a greater responsibility than religious people. Dan Siegel, do you agree?
Suzanne, first let me say that you've picked out some of the most profound moments in the Seeds of Compassion conference for myself, I can say. And so I want to thank you for that. I'm very, very grateful for the opportunity to actually respond to these questions that you have. So thanks.
You're welcome.
At that moment on the stage, when His Holiness said that, one part of me was concerned that people who were actively devoting their life to religious practice might be having a hard time with him saying that religions had failed to bring more compassion in the world. And then when he went on to say that it's both theistic religions that have a deep belief in God and faith in God, and non-theistic religions like Buddhism, which has a following of a person like the Buddha. And when His Holiness said, you know, it's neither of these kinds of religions that have helped, and then he pointed to the four of us on the stage and said, it's you in science that need to come up with this secular or non-religious form of ethic, of values. It made me feel as a scientist and as a physician a deep sense of responsibility. That if he's right, then in fact science is not just about learning about truth, But we in science and also the helping professions, like medicine and mental health, we need to take on this challenge of really thinking in a larger societal way of how to perhaps take health as a secular ethic and promote what I talk about is bringing things together or integration as in common across all ways of thinking about health. And that's the kind of process that mindfulness can bring. And we in science can actually point to the research that's now available to suggest this reflective skill of developing an awareness of the mind that lets go of judgments and promotes compassion inwardly with self-compassion and extends our compassion from just this near form of compassion to this broader extended form where we can understand the importance of being a part of one human family. That's part of what we need as a species to not only survive in this world, but also to thrive.
UCLA brain researcher Dr. Dan Siegel, author of the book The Mindful Brain. More now with Dr. Pilar San Juan, the research scientist we met earlier on our tour of the Mind Research Network in Albuquerque, New Mexico. She's investigating the impact of meditation practice and mindfulness on the brains of those suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Suzanne asked Dr. San Juan if her work could help us understand better the emotional reactivity of our brains when confronted with the challenges and threats of day-to-day life.
I've often thought that we wouldn't want to, so when we talk about people being emotionally reactive or being more emotional, and what I was talking about before, where people maybe are genetically born with this, I wonder, and this is really just something I wonder about, and I'm going to design something to test it at some point, but I wonder whether in some people, like if you've had that bad childhood and other bad trauma happened to you, then it turns into PTSD or substance abuse. But for other people, those same genes, maybe that's what gives us passion. That's what I wonder. I wonder if Gandhi didn't have those same genes, but he didn't have the bad things that went in between. So he took that same feeling thing strongly and made it into something huge and good. I think people who do have lives like that have a lot of passion for what they do. So I wouldn't want to come up with a drug that would like change that, because I wouldn't want to come up with a drug that got rid of people's emotional reactivity. Also, I don't know, artists. You know, an enormous number of people, probably a lot of scientists, right? So I wouldn't want to come up with a, I don't want to come up with a drug that would get rid of that, or like, you know, something where you change somebody's genes. I have a feeling that that actually might be something bad.
What about mindfulness? Because they say that because the brain is plastic, it's changeable, that the mindfulness can actually help people learn how to regulate their mm-hmm. reaction.
So it lets you be more flexible in how you respond to things. So you can still respond to things with the passion, but not respond to things with the anger. Or like when you do respond with anger, because, you know, even Kabat-Zinn in his one of his books on mindfulness, he has a story about getting really angry about cat food dishes in the sink. That's one of his pet peeves. And he finally learns to take that angry moment instead of yelling at his family. Whenever he finds them in the sink, he takes the angry moment and he learns to examine it and see what it is that's actually going on. And, you know, I think actually, and a lot of psychologists think this is certainly not me alone, and he believes too, that when you find, when you look at anger long enough, is that it usually is covering up something else. I almost believe it's not a real emotion, that it's the fight or flight response that you have to an emotion, a negative emotion. So he describes that experience, for example, and he finds that what he's feeling actually is hurt. His family doesn't care about him. They know he doesn't like the cat food dishes in the sink with the regular human food dishes. I don't either. I totally agree with him. and it is one of my pet peeves, too. So I'm like, yes. But he realizes that what he feels is hurt, that they're not paying attention to his feelings when they do that. They know perfectly well that he doesn't. And then he thinks through the hurt, and he realizes that, you know, most of the time they try not to put them in there, and probably it's only when they're, like, in a hurry or in a rush that they don't put it in there. So most of the time they're trying to be considerate of his feelings, but sometimes they really do think that it's kind of silly. And so sometimes when it's too much trouble, they don't pay attention to what they think are his silly feelings. And then he finds himself no longer angry about it all the time. When he sees them in there, he still feels the disgust, but that's not a big deal. He doesn't feel the hurt. And it's the hurt that caused the anger. And when I've worked with patients for years, one of the things you do with cognitive behavioral therapy is you take down an instance where they had a bad emotion or something bad that happened, and you sort of break it down with them. And like almost like clockwork, they'll come in, especially people with PTSD, and they'll be like, anger, because like, what was the emotion you felt? What happened? They describe the whole thing, and what was the emotion? Like, anger. And when you like go back and you look at it with them, you usually find out that it wasn't just anger. There was something before that. It was frustration. It was hurt. It was, they felt like that nobody cared about them. So, or sadness, you know, reminded them of something, somebody they'd lost. So it was giving them grief, and they turned that into anger.
It sounds like that process is using different parts of the brain to sort of analyze what the amygdala is just automatically reacting to.
So if the amygdala has fear, and they turn it into anger. You mean like that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then there's some other part of the brain. What other part of the brain would do that analysis?
That would be the frontal cortex. They'd be doing that. And it'd be working with other parts of your brain, too, because it'd be working with your hippocampus to remember, like, previous times where you were hurt or insulted, you know, and, like, putting it all together into the whole world's against you thing. So, but yeah, mostly it's the prefrontal cortex, working with other parts of the brain, too, but the whole frontal cortex for different kinds of feelings.
Is that part of the process of mindfulness? We remember that we've done that analysis, and then we can go back and do it more quickly?
Mm-hmm.
We can see it happening.
It, and you can say to yourself, this is one of those times where I need to stop and actually like notice what's happening. So that's the thing. You take yourself out of just the feeling, and you put yourself into the moment and are noticing what's happening.
Dr. Pilar San Juan works at the Mind Research Network in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And here again is Dr. Richard Davidson from the University of Wisconsin-Madison to talk about his new facility, the Center for Creating a Healthy Mind.
The Center for Creating a Healthy Mind is a new center that we are just launching here at the University of Wisconsin that will, we think, be among the world's leaders in the new area of contemplative neuroscience, that is the study of the neuroscientific basis of some of the world's great contemplative traditions, and particularly the cultivation of virtuous qualities of mind that lie at the heart of these contemplative traditions. So our center will have at its focus the neuroscientific study of constructs like compassion, cooperation, loving kindness, forgiveness. These are all topics which, for the most part, have been relegated to kind of soft science and social science, if any science. We believe the time is ripe for the rigorous neuroscientific examination of these very important qualities of mind, and a major thrust of the center will be on the study of practices that can cultivate these qualities, both in children as well as in adults.
Because I hear a lot of people say they can't handle conflict, they don't know what to do with conflict, but you're saying that qualities like cooperation and forgiveness actually can be trained. They're not necessarily innate.
Absolutely. Every shred of evidence from modern neuroscience instructs us that not only is that a possibility, but it really has to be a necessity from everything we know about how the brain works. And so it really is the case that just as it would be unthinkable to believe that someone can pick up a musical instrument and play mellifluously on the first try, we shouldn't think that when we just first start to practice cooperation and altruism and compassion, that we're necessarily going to be that good at it. We may have had opportunities for practice in the past, but most of us have never done intentional practice to cultivate these qualities. And just as we can achieve expertise in many other domains, there's every reason to believe that we can achieve expertise in creating virtuous qualities of mind through the intentional cultivation of these qualities.
Dr. Davidson, all of this information about brain research is really exciting, but it's a little bit scary in terms of the future. I wonder how you think about 100 years from now. Will we use the brain's plasticity to make everybody the same? We'll all just be calm and peace-loving?
I'm not too worried about that prospect. First of all, I do think that the world would be a better place if all of us were a little calmer and more peace-loving. But I'm not worried that that the wonderful richness of human diversity is in danger of being blunted. The fact of individual variation is really a dramatic fact about the brain. No two brains are alike. Not even two brains of identical twins are identical. And that's because they've had different experiences, beginning in utero. And so we know that experience shapes the brain in these important ways. And in order for societies to function, we need to have human variation, because there are certain people who are good at certain things and less good at other things. And there is a natural kind of specialization of talent. And so, I think that there is always going to be diversity. And what we're talking about here is just bringing everyone up several notches, but while still retaining the diversity that exists.
If the brain is so malleable and plastic and I can change who I am, then who am I?
Well, this is a question that philosophers have pondered for a long time. And one of the corollaries of the question you're asking is whether there really is a kind of solid fixed self in there that remains invariant over time. And I think there's a very clear answer from neuroscience research, and the answer is no. There is no solid self in there, and there's no place in the brain that is the seat of the self. This is, by the way, remarkably consistent with the view that was described more than 2,500 years ago in the Buddhist contemplative tradition, where there is also the discussion of the illusion of a solid self. It's not to say that we don't use the term myself for the purposes of negotiating in the world and for everyday transactions. No one would argue with that. But in terms of whether there is this core set of characteristics that remains invariant over time, I think the answer to that really is no.
Dr. Davison, could you put in just a few sentences what you most want people to know about brain research as it relates to peace?
What I'd like people to know most about the brain research is that we can take responsibility for our own brains. Our brains are being shaped wittingly or unwittingly by the events and the people around us. And if we take more responsibility for cultivating positive qualities of mind, I think that we can all have a more significant impact on peacemaking in our world.
That's Dr. Richard Davidson from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. For links to our guests' websites, their research and writing, and more on this discussion of the neuroscience of compassion, you can visit our website, peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com, where you can also hear all of the programs in our series, order CDs, sign up for a podcast or a newsletter, and it's also where you can make a tax-deductible contribution to our nonprofit media organization that produces this program. Donations from people like you help us continue this work, protecting part of the media landscape for talk about peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. Any amount will help, so do your part at peacetalksradio.com. Additional support comes from the Oppenheimer Brothers Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation of New Mexico, the Peace Tales CD Project at peacetales.org, and KUNM at the University of New Mexico. Ali Adelman composed and performed our theme music. For Suzanne Kreider, I'm Paul Ingalls. Thanks for listening to Peace Talks Radio.